Okay, this is Joe Spillane and Nancy Campbell. It's January 3rd, 2007, and we've got just a few follow-up questions for Dr. Harris. So one of the things that came up in your earlier interview, and I know it's been a while.
A couple of years, that's right.
One of the subjects that came up in your earlier interview, but only briefly, was your work with the World Health Organization and their reviews of drugs under the Psychotropic Convention. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about how you actually first got involved with working with their committee.
Well, I first got involved when I was invited to become a member of the expert panel.
Right.
And and what had transpired is that the convention was 1971, but it took until 1976 before it finally got approved by all of the nations in order to make it in force. So it wasn't in force until several years after it had become a convention. And in the early convention, there was a section of what they were going to control, the names of the compounds. Were very small and very limited. And so the early days were devoted to two things, as I remember it. One was to define what else we were going to look at that wasn't in the law so that we could cover it. Mm-hmm. And the second thing was then to look at the requirements of the convention to see what we would need in order to make decisions about controlling things. And so there were a number of meetings, and some of them got published, about how you evaluate dependence liability. And those were the early starts of that. Mm-hmm. And we had a couple of meetings to go over that part. Then, once we had sort of settled on what we were going to do, then the expert committee, WHO, came to CPDD and said, "Yeah, we need information, and will you start testing these compounds?" And so, seriatim, we did first the depressants, the barbiturates, the non-barbiturate set of hypnotics, and it was just then that the beginning of the benzodiazepine era started. And they weren't ever even mentioned, beforehand. Or there were a few barbiturates included. But then we started on the benzodiazepine, which took several years to do. But the non-set of hypnotics, that got taken care of pretty quickly, and we controlled those that we thought should be controlled and others we didn't think could be controlled. Next came the stimulants, the amphetamines, the non-cocaine things. One of the big problems was that the single convention covered cocaine, and it didn't cover any other stimulants. It covered marijuana, but it didn't cover the active principles of marijuana. So we had a big to-do about what do we control, because then people were developing the active principle of marijuana, delta-9 THC, as a therapeutic agent, and it finally came out. And so that was another thing we hassled with. The third thing, which was the one that was I suppose, a key to me, was the agonist-antagonist analgesics, many of us, science community, felt that they did not belong under the single convention, that they should be under the psychotropic convention. Mm-hmm. And we won that battle.
And on what grounds did you?
On what grounds that the pharmacological effects were quite distinctly different from, and the dependence liability was different from, because everything in the conventions, even the United States laws, is pharmacological equivalence. So that if something is pharmacologically equivalent, then it's got to be considered in that fashion. And so, and we had a good deal of argument about. The classical antagonists like naloxone and naltrexone and nalorphine before it, do these things really fit the definition of a dependence-producing drug? Mm-hmm. They don't, and therefore, should they be covered? And then the single convention guy said, well, it's in the single convention that anything that's chemically related to, right. That can be shown to be derivative of, then that's got to be covered.
Mm-hmm.
You were stuck with that, and that was one of the big fights about buprenorphine. And the United States, the same thing. We're having the same struggle here with that, and it was tried to be scheduled by IDEA on three separate occasions. The first time, the company really protested, and it was turned over to a law judge.
Mm-hmm.
And many of us made testimony during that time, and convinced the law judge that these things were not simple derivatives. It's not like taking morphine and making heroin out of it. It was a long synthetic process. The second time, the law judge, again, the DEA brought it back again, and the law judge this time, again, was convinced because John Lewis came and had a synthetic scheme where he took acetyl salicylic acid and made buprenorphine from acetyl salicylic acid. And so, but then the DEA went and scheduled it anyhow, so it didn't make any difference. They overrode.
Did that reflect a change in the law, that the DEA had the ability to do that?
Or I think that was the interpretation that was made.
It was changing the interpretation.
Changing the interpretation. Yeah, but, to get back to the WHO, these things were going on all parallel to that. Then the benzodiazepines was a very long struggle with those. They were different. It was obvious when you saw them they were different. And we're not typically barbiturate. We had a great deal of difficulty, for instance, in making animals in the early days dependent on it. We didn't have the techniques. Before that, we had the techniques for the opiates, we had the techniques for the barbiturates, but we didn't have the techniques. And then they kept coming out one after another after another. At one time, we had 32 benzodiazepines under consideration at the World Health Organization. And each company fighting for its own, and it was really a battle, a real commercial battle. Because the barbiturates was no market.
How did you approach that as a scientific problem?
As a scientific problem, developed methodology. There was the beginning, for instance, of the development of drug discrimination was coming along. Mm-hmm. The other problem was how could we get these things to be self-administered when it was difficult to get them into solution?
Okay.
But those problems gradually became solved, and then the degree of public health problems with them was also very difficult. So the thing we're still fighting with, how do you know that there is public health damage being done by these compounds? That's part of the convention.
So I want to go back to who else you served with in the beginning. Who else do you remember being part of?
Oh, Yanagida from mm-hmm. Japan. Mm-hmm. Bob Schuster was always a part of it. Jim Woods sometimes. But we were also developing the methodology, and we're still developing. How do we go about what is going to be the scheme that you use in order to arrive at a decision? Guidelines.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Everybody wanted guidelines. We must have developed at least four or five sets of guidelines over the years, and they're still developing guidelines. And the calls are still out to our FDA, for instance, to develop guidelines. They've never published guidelines about to guide the companies or to guide the scientists. What do you do with these things? And we just had a couple of sessions like that, symposia recently, one that CPDD, a couple of CPDD sponsored, and one that Tufts people have gotten into this now. That Tufts group has been holding conferences and meetings. And
you mentioned the difficulty in assessing, for example, the benzodiazepines as a public health problem. At the time that you really began looking at them, how would you characterize the state of our knowledge or data.
They were much safer. Mm-hmm. It was very difficult to kill yourself with them or to kill anybody with them. Barbiturates were easy. Mm-hmm. You had a lot of overdose deaths, but it was very difficult to get an overdose, a death overdose, sure, with the benzodiazepines. That was a real factor in this, especially in the United States, where our law covers suicide as a dependence sign.
Yeah.
Okay, that's how we classified propoxyphene. Propoxyphene was another big issue, in that Davon was out there. It was a very major thing. It was a thing that all physicians were using as an analgesic. It was supposedly non-dependence producing. We could show it had opiate-like effects, but it really was not representing any real public health problem until people started using it to commit suicide.
Mm-hmm. Was
and then there were a rash of suicides that brought attention to this. And so,
was there much debate about whether or not suicide was a form of abuse? I mean,
when the U.S. law was being formulated, it was about the same time as the Psychotropic Convention. They were running it parallel. Of course, Nathan Eddy was involved with both of those processes. He was another key issue. Dale Cameron at the WHO was also a key player. And the first executive secretary that I really had things to do with was Inayat Khan, who ran mm-hmm. the committee for many years. And Hans Halbach was also at the WHO. He was the original editor and founder of that journal, Drug and Alcohol Dependence.
Right, and then he was an old-timer.
Yeah,
He had been there with Isbell.
But they... Again, the WHO situation was a very complicated one because their expert committees had to reflect something more than science. They were science committees, but they had to reflect, and in those early days, we had to have geographical distribution. We had to have political distribution. In other words, the communist bloc had to be represented as well as the Westerners. Developing countries versus developed countries. So there were pretty diverse groups of people on these committees.
So how did you handle that, given that so much of the judgment call was supposed to be scientific, because by and large,
the data that we had to work with was all essentially scientific data. We still we always had the problem of incidence of abuse. And how do you measure that? And when it comes right down to it, to this day, there are only two real sources, the Scandinavians and the United States, that have got any reliable data, to collect any reliable data. And we're still worried about that. There's a new committee that's been formed to look at pharmacovigilance. How do we look for signs of what's going to be a problem so that we can step in early on and prevent the problem from happening? And we've got a meeting coming up soon on that in Geneva that is going to look at that.
I just ran into that term just about a month ago for the first time. Is that an emergent way of talking about
yeah,
it?
Yeah, it's going to be. It's this guy named Schulten who's just taken over as the executive secretary of the expert committee, S-C-H-O-L-T-E-N.
So you continue to be involved?
Yeah. Yeah. As a matter of fact, when I was in the executive of the CPDD is when we drove them to become a collaborating center. That took place, and the collaborating center just ended its term this last year, and I put in the whole reapplication for mm-hmm. getting
so you've
out
been
of
continuously involved
yeah.
since 1976.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Since before 1976, I've got to find something. During the Nixon administration, when he created the Special Action Office, they looked at the problem, and the problem we had in those days, it was everyone's attention was heroin. It was all anyone was concerned about, really. Marijuana hadn't started yet. You know, we had all of this stuff, and so the brains at the executive branch said, well, What's the problem? The problem is heroin. Where does heroin come from? Heroin comes from morphine. Where does morphine come from? Morphine comes from opium. Where does opium come from? Poppies. Ergo, get rid of the poppies, we get rid of the opium, we get rid of the morphine, get rid of the heroin, solve the problem. So they started out with whole sorts of programs. They were, Department of Agriculture were looking for specific insects that would eat just opium poppies. They had programmed satellites that were going to pick out the fields by the colors of the poppies when they bloomed, and they were going to spread herbicides all over the places. And so finally, some sense began to prevail, and they said, what would be the impact of this? Because the question that was asked to us was, could the synthetic compounds that were not made from directly from opium suffice to take care of medicine in the world? And so we were commissioned by a combination of the World Health Organization, CPDD, and the pharmaceutical industry to do a global study of this. And it's in one of these reports, by the way, that I lost in that thing, but I finally found a copy of it. I have to see if I can dig that up. I don't know whether it's at home here, but Joe Cochin and I were the ones that did this. He was the executive secretary of CPDD at that time. And we went around the world to ask this question, and it was, and then the AMA people did very big marketing studies, economic studies that were published at the same time. And of course, what we discovered was, first of all, yes, it would be possible to substitute synthetics, but this was not going to be acceptable because the price of the medicines would, particularly in the developing countries, would be abnormally high. Only ones that were really in favor of this were the Scandinavians, because they can control things. But we went to, the response of the government of India was, we'll put 200,000 people out of work tomorrow if you get rid of the opium, and we can't, we can't afford to do that sort of thing. And most of the developing countries were strongly opposed because, and then it was codeine. It was the only cough medicine that we had. And so, that sort of quieted down and stopped that movement in its tracks.
Mm-hmm. You remember the name of the report?
Yeah, I've got it. It's on my CV someplace.
Okay.
I'm sure. I know I found a copy when I was going through some boxes at home.
So, I'm sorry.
Yeah, but to go ahead with this, another thing we just beginning to face are the hallucinogens. We've never been really adequately equipped to handle the hallucinogens.
Yeah, that's
LSD
usually the question.
Was yeah. And we control a number of things that we had, good solid LSD, psilocybin, mescaline, and things like that everybody could agree upon. But then there were whole new classes coming out, and they're still coming out like mad all over the place. And some of them are so closely related to amphetamine, where do they really belong in this thing? And so,
are you speaking of MDMA?
MDMA, there are a lot of these Shulgin compounds,
yes.
We call them.
Yes. Right. Understand.
Yeah. And we're still fighting the buprenorphine. We fought the buprenorphine thing last year in the expert committee. I was not a member of the expert committee because I rotated off the panel. But I get myself invited as CPDD's expert, collaborating senator, to be present. I could talk and express opinion and so forth, but I couldn't vote. But the people that favor the single convention and heavy controls is the Commission on Narcotic Drugs and the International Narcotics Control Board. This is the ones that have power, and they keep bringing things up again. And this time they got voted down on practically everything that they wanted to do. I mean, for instance, ketamine was scientifically, there's no way you can distinguish ketamine from phencyclidine. Mm-hmm. Phencyclidine is controlled, but the committee said that in the psychotropic convention, therapeutic utility can override abuse liability. And this is a very important therapeutic agent in the developing world. They couldn't do surgery any place without ketamine. It's a generally used anesthetic every place. You know, in a tropical climate, you can't use gases or liquids. You've got ketamine, and it's also used as an analgesic agent. And so there was a very strong representation that should not be controlled. It remains uncontrolled internationally. These are the sort of things that...
How well has scheduling done balancing therapeutic utility and abuse liability?
Well, it's been difficult at the international level because the international law defines therapeutic utility as a drug being registered for sale as a prescription drug in a small number of countries, maybe 3 or 4 is all you need to have to make it useful. Okay. Mm-hmm. We ran into a terrible problem with that with so-called exempt products. That's also written into the convention. There's something called exempt products. That if you could put together a controlled substance in a formulation, either with something else or a formulation that would make it difficult for people to abuse, then you could apply for an exempt status, and that so-called product would be exempt from the controls. And this started out with a very... each country had to notify the WHO that we want to exempt these compounds. And it started out very early on as a relatively simple thing. A few countries like Finland, as I remember, and in France put in a handful of compounds, and we looked at them. Typical example of a terrible travesty was Bulgaria was a maverick country in those days, and they put forth an exempt preparation that had 500 milligrams of aspirin and 10 milligrams of D-amphetamine, saying the aspirin prevented the abuse of the D-amphetamine. And of course, that was easy to cut that up. But there were all these herbal mixtures that had all sorts of things mixed in together, and we had a devilish time with that, and we held it. Couple of meetings to try and define what would make something exempt or not, and then thanks to the United States government, who applied for exempt status for nearly 2,000 combinations at one time, and that's just to overwhelm the system. That after much debate and everything, we decided, and it still remains, that we would not bother with exempt preparations at the international level. We leave it up to the countries involved to take care of that problem. But there are a whole... I mean, if you look in our files, the WHO files, you'll find several meetings that were held that completely non-archival, that reports were developed and that never saw the light of day. I mean, I wrote some of those things. You know, how do you define what, you know... You put something to make people vomit. You used to put anticholinergic. Well, that was the case with the first anti-diarrheal agent called diphenoxylate, Lomotil. Mm-hmm. That came from Janssen's laboratory in Belgium. He presented evidence in scientific papers that he had this new drug which had anti-diarrheal activity but did not have analgesic activity, and therefore it was not getting in, you know, it's distinctly different. It doesn't produce dependence based on that evidence. And they began marketing it in Europe, and then it came to Nathan Eddy and the CPDD, which, you know, asked for it to be looked at more carefully. I was at Sterling at that time. It was early 60s, and it was a meperidine derivative. We had thousands of meperidine compounds working on it. We knew, so we made the reverse ester of the compound and we tested it. And I couldn't believe that it was, from all the experience we'd had with meperidine derivatives. But then it repeated his stuff that he reported with diphenoxylate with our compound. Sure enough, the data as he reported it was very. Very good. And I kept gnawing at me, and I began to think about this, and I said, the light dawned. He did all of the anti-diarrheal activity by oral administration, and all the analgesic activity by subcutaneous administration.
Oh.
You reverse the process, it's no longer an antidiarrheal agent, but it is analgesic. So it's a matter of absorption and biodistribution and so forth. But at the suggestion of Eddie and the CPDD executive at that time, they decided this was a very useful drug and it should be allowed. So they suggested that the company add a very small homeopathic amount of atropine to it. And that people, the adverse effects of the atropine, if somebody tried to abuse it, would overcome.
Mm-hmm. And is that what is essentially a Schedule 5 drug now?
Well, yeah, it went out as it went out unscheduled. It was never scheduled. And not well. The diphenoxylate was scheduled, but not the preparation.
Right. I happen to be looking at Schedule 5 drugs recently, and these drugs are on.
Yeah, yeah. And then recently, it's a decade or more ago, they came out with Vocaramide, which has got exactly the same properties, maybe a little less CNS stuff in it, and that's over-the-counter now.
So can you tell us maybe a little more about Nathan Eddy and how...
Yeah. He was a remarkable person. He really was. I mean, I should have asked Dr. May. I mean, I had my own few years of experience with him. It wasn't... I didn't know him that long, because I was at Stirling, and we were working on this new dependence and less dependence producing analgesics. We were in constant collaboration with him and his group with Everett and so forth, because we wanted to work in the same area that they were working, because we thought that held the greatest promise. But he was a dominating person in the field. Dominated not only the United States, but he dominated the international stuff. I mean, all he had to do was tell the DEA this is should be scheduled or this shouldn't be scheduled, and he went to all these meetings. He was never official, but he always was the scientific person that came. The State Department goes to these commission meetings, and he was brought along, and he would tell the State Department the way they should behave. I mean, he had very strong feelings about science and its importance. In a very strong drive to develop, thought it could very easily be, we could develop non-dependence producing potent, effective analgesics. He ran the Committee of Narcotics, and then this college, well, that was not committee on problems of drug dependence. In the early days, for instance, he would stand at the door, and only scientists were allowed in. There were no news media were allowed to come into the meetings. The meetings were quite different at that time, and you can tell by the minutes. People made reports. It was a very strong discussion. It was a committee sitting around. It wasn't a public meeting or a scientific meeting. It was a working group meeting, and he was a curmudgeon, no question about it, and a very avid bridge player, and he got stuck me on a number of occasions. I had a technician, Ann Pearson, who was a bridge player, and I played bridge at some. And he had Frank Fraser as his partner always, and they had been playing together for decades. And then toward the end, it was one night, as I remember, we were at one of these meetings, and I had a friend Harry Paz that created this company up in Cambridge. He was at Arthur D. Little. In any case, he was one of these flamboyant guys that pushy and so forth, and he decided he was going to replace Ann as a partner, and he didn't know anything about how to play bridge. Certainly not. We were paying for money, and not cheap money either. In any case, he was my partner, and he kept playing horribly. He didn't know what he was doing, and finally I got mad. I'm quitting. I'm saying, and he said, take it easy. The boy's doing fine, because they were making a lot of money.
Was that P-A-S?
P-A-R-S.
P-A-R-S.
P-A-R-S, yeah.
P-A-R-S. Well, so that brings us to Arthur D. Little. You want to talk a bit about the Army incapacitating agent?
Yeah, that's where I first got to meet Harry Paz. He was at Sterling, and all of a sudden, out of the blue, this guy shows up, and the Institute management put together a committee of us to meet with him. He was trying to sell us on the idea of getting involved with this new program that the Department of Defense was putting together called the Incapacitating Agent Program.
And what year do you think that was?
Probably around 1960, I'd say, in that era. They were soliciting things from pharmaceutical companies to join them in this effort. We knew a number of people who were involved in that. John Beale was a chemist and was involved in that, and Abbott Laboratories was involved in this thing, a number of the big companies. But he came to us with the idea that we could be partners, and that we had a very strong CNS program. We had a lot of stuff going on, not only just the opiate, the analgesic stuff, but a lot of other stuff. And what he brought to the table was the fact that for this program, early before it, you know, it really got started, he had been contracted through, he was at Arthur D. Little, one of the staff, and they lived on contracts. And he had gotten a contract from the Edgewood Arsenal, the Army's Chemical Research and Development Laboratories, to make a large supply of Delta-9 THC from the natural, from the plant material, you know, extract it, purify it, make pure stuff, which was, we had begun to think about, since they, you know, they were beginning to see the publications on the pure chemical compound, and knowing that we had a history, I had a history of knowing what was going on in that field because of contacts with my thesis and all of that stuff. That was an intriguing thing. It was a plant material and a compound that produced very profound CNS effects, which we really didn't understand very much about, but it looked like it, you know, might be a potential therapeutic agent, and therefore it gave us an entree into that field. So we agreed to join together with them to submit a joint contract between Sterling Drug and Arthur D. Little to do this, and there were mainly chemists at Arthur D. Little, and we had the pharmacology backup, although we did a lot of chemistry too at that time too in the programs that we were interested in. And this started, I thought it was a very big program, we had a lot of work that we were doing with anticholinergic agents, centrally acting anticholinergic agents. Mm-hmm. We had some very powerful ones. That was their lead agent, was something called BZ. It was a very potent John Beale's compound. JB was for John Beale. Very potent anticholinergic.
B-E-A-L?
Yeah, let's put it that way. I'm not sure that's okay. The exact spelling. It may be B-E-E-L.
Okay.
And we had gotten into that area. Again, it was a backdoor area. We were the owners of a compound which was the treatment of choice. It was an anticholinergic for Parkinson's disease at that time. This was before we knew that catecholamines, dopamine was involved. That was all still to come in the future. And the trouble was that it wasn't a very good therapeutic agent. I was in charge of all the CNS drugs. It was something that we were trying to improve upon, and I got the idea that the problem with it is that the side effects, the anticholinergic, the peripheral side effects, blurred vision, dilated pupils, gastrointestinal problems, data of the gut, urinary problems, were interfering with the therapy. You couldn't get the dose high enough to have the therapeutic effect without causing so many side effects, so that we should look for an anticholinergic that had a much higher central to peripheral ratio. Mm-hmm. Okay. And when we had research teams, project teams, and I brought this idea up to Sid Archer, who was the chemist at that time, and he said, "Well, what do you suggest?" And I said, "Well, you know,
Scopolamine is the only anticholinergic out there that's got a reasonable central to peripheral ratio, and it was a, you know, and he said, well, now we can't go in that direction. It's too difficult to put that oxygen bridge in. It's chemically not feasible to go in that direction at all. And so I said, well, it came back a few, you know, another couple of weeks went by. We had another meeting. I said, well, your cocaine looks like atropine, the structure. He said, oh, you've got it. We can start with econine, and we can put these various side chains on that's going to make it anticholinergic. So we started a synthetic program, and he made the diphenylpropane derivative of econine. And it's a very, was a relatively easy synthesis. He had a very small amount of this, and he gave us that few milligrams, and we stuck it in a few animals, and God, it was the most potent anticholinergic that we ever studied. It never got a name. It was called Win 1975. Sorry. All of our compounds were called Win compounds from Winthrop. In any case, we took that compound. He synthesized a total of, I'd say, probably less than 100 milligrams. We did the full pharmacological profile and toxicology and brought it into the clinic on that amount of drug, which was a fantastic. Well, of course, we didn't have the FDA hadn't, we didn't have all this clinical stuff to interfere with, no INDs, no.
How in did any you case, bring it into the clinic?
Did the toxicology, got a clinician to start sticking it into people.
Which clinician would that be?
I can't remember the name of the guy now, but.
But you had folks.
We had folks, yeah. We had folks lined up, yeah. People were interested in that, were treating Parkinsonism. And, there were no drugs that was working, so they, I mean, what they were doing was they classical case, one of the famous professors at Harvard came down with Parkinson, and what they were doing was injecting alcohol into the brain, trying to destroy the areas that were involved, and it was a very risky thing. It worked sometimes, but he had this thing done. He became a vegetable, and people were eager to try this, and so they put it into a few people, and it produced severe psychotomimetic activity instead of, it did nice things for the tremors and stuff like that, but and then of course we had a whole series of compounds, but it fit exactly into the incapacitating agent program. Very potent, all the peripheral ratio of one, so it could be, you know, it could be used, and it was a big deal. And then of course the other thing that they were interested in anticholinergic because they were nerve gas antidotes. Mm-hmm. So atropine plus an enzyme and stimulant is now that's what's in all the kits for nerve gas.
So that was their other interest.
Yeah, that was their other interest.
Okay, so how much did you know at the time? It's the Army Chemical Corps, right?
Yeah.
So how much did you know about the scope of the program?
Well, we knew a lot about it because we used to have general meetings. We used to meet together, all the contractors, periodically.
And where did you meet?
Chemical Research and Development Laboratories in Edgewood.
Down in Edgewood?
Yeah.
And who at Edgewood did you work with?
Oh, God. I'd have to look that stuff up. I can't remember. But one of the leading lights was Leo Abood, was from the University of Rochester, was one of the... he was a very potent, a very strong consultant to the group. And he chaired many of the meetings. And his daughter got her degree with us.
Was Joe Brady involved then?
Joe Brady was not involved in this.
Not that, okay.
No.
And there's another
but
lab.
There were a lot of people involved in this. When we had not only the antiquity, the 5-HT stuff was a very potent thing because of the LSD area. We were doing a lot of work in that. We had some major tranquilizers that looked as possibilities. The whole thing fell apart because of it was beginning to become evident that the Army people were being too risky with testing this stuff in people.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about the LSD work that you were doing.
Well, we had some simpler molecules that we were looking at as LSD-like substances. It never turned out to be very, very much. We managed to get a paper out of it. So a lot of the stuff is still classified, by the way.
Yeah. Do you think that Lexington was involved?
Lexington was involved, yes.
In the LSD stuff?
Well, in some of the Army stuff. And the LSD stuff was a fiasco because...
Yeah.
they decided that to test it, you know, and they did some simulation stuff where they had people, you know, trying to fire anti-aircraft guns, and they gave them LSD, and the guns were, you know, going all over in all directions and so forth. And then they decided to field test it, where there was live ammunition being shot at people, and they were on the LSD, and they were supposed to, and they shot back very accurately once they were being actually fired at.
Really?
So it didn't interfere with anything.
So where did they do that?
That was probably done at Edgewood. That wouldn't do it any place else except on a base.
Mm-hmm. Right. How do you know Lexington was involved?
I don't know that Lexington was involved. I really don't. It's just a suspicion that Lexington was involved.
So you don't have...
I don't have any... I have to go back and look at... There, you know, I don't know how much records I've still got of any of that stuff. I had to leave all that stuff at Sterling. I couldn't take anything from Sterling.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I ask because I have just written a lot about Lexington, and I couldn't find any actual evidence.
They did test LSD, but that was independent of anything.
Right.
It was independent of anything.
That's what I thought, too.
I don't think they were involved in it.
You don't think so?
I don't think so.
And was the Army Chemical Corps incapacitating agent program, was there intelligence involved as well? Was the CIA involved in that?
Well, I'll tell you, the only reason I think that they might have been involved was the fact that after we published that paper on those indole derivatives, mm-hmm. I got some angry calls about people telling me, how could you possibly have worked for the CIA? And, you know, that was when things was years later after the program was...
In the 70s, MKUltra came to light and all that.
Yeah. And I said, well, I had no idea that CIA was involved in this. Well, yes, I'm telling you that CIA, some investigative reporter from one of the newspapers had dug out this stuff. And I said, as far as I know, they had nothing to do with this project. And besides that, this has nothing in it that's of any importance to anybody, except it provided another research paper for my CV.
Was that John Marks who wrote the book?
I don't know.
The Search for the Manchurian Candidate?
I don't know.
I mean, he alleges that Lexington, you know, that they were all involved. But again, well,
I think if Lexington was really involved in this, I'd have known about it. They might have been asked to do some little study or something, but I don't think that they were actively involved in this.
Yeah.
The Army was doing enough in humans that...
They had other routes.
They had other routes, yeah.
Okay. So when you say it fell apart because the Army was...
Well, I think the times were changing.
Yes.
You know, things were changing. I mean, if people began to realize the limitations of this whole idea. I mean, first of all, you know, he was supposed to be an officer sitting here with his troops, and there were the other troops over there. He would look through his glasses, and they would lob some sort of munition over there, and those people would be incapacitated. You could run in and pick them up and transport them someplace. You know, began to be, you know, the reality began to set in, and they were talking about, well, we were in great danger because somebody could poison our water supplies. Well, LSD was probably one of the most potent things we had, and you could dump truckloads into the water supply, and you couldn't get enough into the concentration going into people's houses to do anything. You just think that the dilution factor was so much greater than possible. So I think the strong dose of reality began to filter in.
And about but when it, was that?
It was in the mid '60s. I was already at North Carolina. It was sort of the end. It was the end of the '60s, the beginning of the '70s. I still had a secured facility at North Carolina. In my house, not in the university.
Could you explain that a little bit about that?
Well,
that, you know, the only thing that was secret was putting together the chemistry and the pharmacology together, okay? And although we could do some studies in the university, we wanted to keep it divorced from the university, mm-hmm. okay? And therefore, anything that had to do with classified information had to be run out of my own house. So I still have the same security container. It's a huge fireproof safe and combination and everything like that. They didn't ask for it back, and I just kept it.
You know, sorry. I'm just imagining that as an exhibit.
Yes, it's
true. Don't put that down in writing. Well, it's very important. Have you ever gone through security, had official security? Oh, you got it. They send, I got things there that are important to me that I would never remember. The addresses of every place my family lived back before I was born, and dates of all the relatives and names of families, and the whole bit of, they do a pretty thorough investigation. This was, it was never top secret, but I was cleared to secret anyhow. And,
so when you said that the only thing that was secret was when you put the chemistry and the pharmacology together, what did you mean?
Well, if you just did a study and you were looking at effects of drug X, Y, and Z, that's not classified. As long as you don't, but when you put the structure together with the pharmacology, then that becomes classified information. Now, we're going through that battle now. I mean, there's a big thing out there. It's not has nothing to do with drugs or chemicals anymore. It has to do with high-tech stuff in physics and radioactivity and stuff like that, where people, I mean, this is a battle that's still being, you know, what is the government gonna classify? Can you publish stuff now? Because of the new national security laws, can you publish stuff now that might contribute to an enemy getting something that could be used against us?
I see.
Yeah. Don't forget, we had this big, great, big communist empire out there that we were battling, and you know, those of us who were at places like WHO and, you know, were working with committees, just couldn't understand this because they were so backward. I mean, the only thing that they were good at was mathematics and physics. Mm-hmm. They had no idea of how to develop drugs, or they had no pharmaceutical industry. They had nothing. They had no economy. It was hard to be for anybody that knew technologically where we were in the West. Why anyone was scared of these people? Because we had reached very early on an impasse about the atom bomb. Nobody was going to use an atom bomb. Mm-hmm. And so we have thousands of them, they have thousands of them, so what? Mm-hmm. I'm sorry.
No, that's...
you don't remember the ticking clocks we had. People were building bomb shelters. In their houses, storing food and water in them. And they had drills in the schools. Kids, they would ring the siren, and the kids would dive under their desk. You know, what the good was that going to do them? And kids, somebody dropped an atom bomb on you. I mean, it was a pretty peculiar time in our history.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, we're getting away from all sorts of things like this.
Interesting.
Well, so the ending of the...
Well, the benzodiazepines was the most difficult thing we had to really face, was to get those scheduled right. And we finally, you know, had some of them became more dependence, began to have a public dependence liability that overwhelmed the public health system. Some of them were getting distributed particularly into developing countries. They were in the illicit marketplace.
Yes,
so to speak.
And didn't Roland Griffiths and that
yeah,
group of people,
that group of people, they were the ones that did the benzodiazepine, most of the work with the benzodiazepines. Mm-hmm. They had developed a baboon as a model, and
They did most of the pharmacological work on the benzodiazepines. We did a little bit of it, but in rodents. Mm-hmm. But they provided most of it. And the formula was developed that before you classified anything, you had to do a critical review. And so a format for a critical review was prepared, what had to go into it. Mm-hmm. You know, it was very strict. You know, chemistry had to be described carefully and named. All the therapeutic utility stuff had to be spelled out. The pharmacology, the toxicology, the dependence, the liability, the incidence of illicit traffic, all of that stuff had to be developed into a document which could then be used by the expert committee. Mm-hmm. And the trouble was, and it's the same thing we keep coming back to, where does this data come from, and is it good data? Because most of the stuff that you got in was just apocryphal. It was stories that government said, well, we got a terrible problem with this drug. Well, where's your data on it? And mm-hmm. at least in the United States, we had Dawn, this early warning system, which was fine, except that it was not very well controlled. But it was at least data that you were putting numbers on and quote. And then the FDA began to develop adverse events. Mm-hmm. Data, but how that does that relate to the abuse potential was a difficult thing to pull out.
Sure.
In the Dawn data, all you had to do, there were Dawn mentions, mm-hmm. and all they had a death come in, they would take blood samples and to screen it, and they were trying 10 different drugs in there. Well, if that was a mention, whether that drug had anything to do with the problem or not was still questionable. So mm-hmm. we're still fussing with that. There was some of the seizure stuff, they relied practically entirely on the Scandinavian countries, United States, and Interpol. Mm-hmm. And Interpol used to come up with some interesting stuff from time to time. They used to make seizures, and they could say, over the last year we seized 10 million doses of particular benzodiazepine. That was evidence that it was getting into the illicit marketplace. Mm-hmm. Maybe it should be tighter controlled.
Mm-hmm. So
one time they caught, they were sitting in the airport in, I think it was Saudi Arabia, and some boxes came into the carousel, a whole pile of boxes, and they opened up one of the boxes and they found it stacked with the benzodiazepines. And it was a diplomatic pouch. Mm-hmm. That somebody from the diplomatic corps or the royal family brought this stuff in. Inadvertently, they found this stuff, and so that led to stricter controls in that particular benzodiazepine, because the Saudis weren't using it there. They were transshipping it to Africa. Going into the illicit
market. So it was really a combination of evidence of illicit market plus evidence of adverse.
Right.
Or consequences with, or abuse.
And consequences of abuse, we're still looking at what are the consequences. I mean, recently there's a big piece in the New York Times about, just today, an editorial. Did you see that about our data on childhood, the surveys?
Yeah.
Saying the government is saying there's been a great decrease in abuse, particularly among, we've been concentrating on teens for the last 25 years. It turns out that the problem was adults. And now they're beginning to develop the data on adults, and the picture is quite different. It's quite different. Mm-hmm. You should look at that editorial today.
So overall, you would say our data is better now than it was, let's say, a quarter century ago?
Yeah. I think our data is better. Okay. I mean, the household survey didn't exist. I mean, it was high school and then the household surveys, they were just beginning to be developed by Johnson and the group at University of Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And just think about the expense of that. You in order to make it meaningful, you got to have, N has got to be very big, I think, in the household. High school surveys, now 60,000 kids get interviewed. But I look at that data over time, and I don't see any, you could make a case that things have stayed pretty stable. There were some blips here and there. I think that smoking went down pretty dramatically for a while. And, mm-hmm. Alcohol went down. I think that in among the teenagers, but it's gone up like mad among adults.
Hmm. Yeah, it's Interesting. I wanted to ask you, we didn't get into this before. You started a monkey colony, or you continued a monkey colony that had been started at NIDA?
No, at Michigan.
At Michigan. So we, even though they still have monkeys at Michigan...
Yeah, well, let me try to explain what was going on at that time. This was the when I moved here shortly after I came here in 1972-73, got a call from Nathan Eddy. They were beginning to be concerned about the monkey colony at Michigan, which was the dependent morphine-dependent colony, which was used to test all opiates for substitution for morphine, because Dr. Sievers had reached retirement age and the university was making noises that they didn't like what was going on. They didn't like this whole business involved with the drugs of abuse and stuff, and that they were afraid that the Michigan would cut out and end the colony. And so Eddie came to me and asked whether we could set one up here, a parallel colony here, which we agreed to do. And so we, with a great deal of help from Michigan, got the colony of monkeys in, and we're still running a dependent monkey colony. Michigan continued to do this for a period of time, and you can just trace that in the records. And then they gave it up too. And so we're the only ones left that, and Yanagita had a colony in Japan, but he's given it up. So we're the only people left with a dependent morphine
when
colony.
When would you say Michigan gave it up?
Well, I can date it exactly from the annual reports, because at one point in the beginning we were naming the compounds, not NIH numbers, but we had UM numbers and MCV numbers on the compounds. And you can just look in there and select out just about the time they stopped working on it.
Okay.
I mean, you can ask. I can ask Mario. He'll know. Mario Aceta's my longtime colleague that runs the colony, actually.
Right.
And we're down to a very small number, and thought we were going to be out of business at the end of this month.
Any other lab that does this?
No.
So can we do without monkeys?
We could use rodents, but I think the whole argument is the monkey better than rodents? I mean, we have a tremendous pressure from the animal rights people.
Yes. Have you experienced?
Well, we used to get protests out here, but then we had Virginia's a little bit tougher place to have protests. We're a much more conservative state, and I don't think the police are. We still have, we used to have them parade in front of those, some woman faculty in the other campus who dressed up in a bunny suit and would walk around. But then we had our students got all exercised about this, and so we had comic demonstrations. We set up booths and tables and so forth. And that sort of we're still a targeted organization. Mm-hmm. We have to be very careful. I don't worry about them. They can protest all they want, march up and down, but when they sneak somebody into the... Mm-hmm. laboratory and they start taking pictures, we could be, these animals do go through withdrawal.
Yeah.
And they are, they only go through for a short period of time, and then we treat them right away and so on and so forth. But it's just like you couldn't do that at Lexington anymore. They're using humans up until
74.
That's when the government stepped in and said no more prisoners.
Mm-hmm.
For medical experiments, although there's a movement now recently starting back to start it again.
Yes, indeed.
So, yeah. Things have a way of going around in circles.
Mm-hmm. So, do you think you will lose the monkey colony?
No, I just was informed just before the Christmas holidays that we put in a new contract. It's mm-hmm. much smaller and it's. It's much more diverse. It's not just a testing. It's tied with drug development.
I was going to ask you about that, because my understanding of what was happening at Michigan was that part of the issue was that this was not, quote, research. It was testing.
Yeah.
Did you run into that problem?
Well, no. Michigan ran into it. Michigan always ran with a grant. We've always operated under contracts.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And contracts are testing. But we've always competed very effectively. It's just that the money situation there now is very difficult, and they've made a decision at NIH that they're going to fund R01 research grants, and they're going to cut the contract funding way back. And
So these are NIH NIDA contracts,
right,
with you.
With me.
And is Jim CPDD involved as well? Yeah, you know, we were with Jim in November. He was worried about losing money.
Yeah, I mean, he's lost all his money. Yeah. He doesn't have any testing money anymore, anything at all. Except we could deal with private companies. We've always tried to stay. We occasionally take in something of which we think is interesting to do it, and go ahead and do it under contract to a company. We're always very open. But we developed formulated rules about the testing program, and it was always CPDD until this contract has always been involved in it. But CPDD is not mentioned in this new contract at all. Mm-hmm. Okay, because we had set up a drug evaluation committee that did the testing, and we had a coordinator. We used to be Art Jacobson, now Andy Coop at Maryland. Mm-hmm. The compounds got sent into him. He put a code number on them. Everything we did do was blind, and I don't know what we're going to do. I don't. There's not much money in this new contract to do that type of testing. We're preserving the colony, but it's not going to. We can't handle dozens of compounds anymore. We can handle handfuls.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it's going to be restricted. And besides, industry has moved. You know, we used to have a lot of industry stuff coming in. They've moved away from it. I think that...
To what?
Oh, they're relying upon more contract research organizations who will do some things. There's nobody doing the monkey stuff. I mean, nobody's interested in opiates anymore, particularly. That's another thing. Companies are interested in new areas. But that may change. It goes up and down too. But they, when a company comes to contract things, they want it done the way they want it done.
Right.
We do it the way we think is the best science way of doing it. So when they come with a compound, they said, test this, but only at this dose.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not what happens when it gets out on the street. You mean the addicts don't pay attention to what the therapeutic dose is. They push things, and we push things.
So you were used to doing sort of high-dose testing rather than what these companies
think. We always give the dose, increasing doses until we reach a point where we see toxicity. Not killing, but just see, you know, toxicity. Then we back off.
Right. You sound like Abe Wickler and Harris Isbell
back
in the 50s, defending high-dose studies. Believe me, I've read almost those very words verbatim in the CPDD proceedings from 1953.
I'm sorry, it is an amazing continuity that's involved in all this stuff. It just never ceases to amaze me how we keep reinventing stuff. And Nida's just asking me, we're still at this thing, why is the monkey preferred? I mean, it's obvious to me why the monkey is preferred. All you can do is look at them. and the metabolism is much closer to man's metabolism than the rodent is.
Do you say that to them?
Yeah.
It's just amazing. It is, you know, so many times that argument has had to be made.
I mean, just there's nothing wrong if you've got people who are willing to volunteer and you make the safeguards in it to do initial testing in humans too. I mean, as long as you've got the background of toxicity and pharmacological effects in animals, so you know what to look for, at least you've got some hints, to start in at very low doses and bring the dose up until you make observations. It's a pretty safe procedure. Except that's not what happens in the real life situation. People begin to get careless, and they begin to want to move too fast. And I just Beecher used to do. One time, we had when I was an undergraduate, I had to work and I had a job as a part-time technician in the Department of Anesthesiology at Massachusetts General Hospital. And my job was to do clinical chemistries and draw bloods from subjects. And they
project that I had nothing to do with Beecher, he was not involved except he was chairman of the department, was how does various anesthetic agents affect liver function? Okay. And this at that time, and is still a typical clinical study where there was no hypothesis. It was, we'll do things and hope we get some results that'll tell us something. Mm-hmm. So they had a very nice setup at the Massachusetts General Hospital. It was divided into sections. There was the Phillips House. These still exist, which was a very exclusive place. They didn't even allow residents in that part of the hospital. This is where all the celebrities and important politicians and so forth went. Then there was, and those were all private rooms with, you know, 24-hour, round-the-clock private nurses. The second was Baker House, which were all semi-private rooms. Those were the upper middle class. There was a White Building, and the White Building was a big research building, but that's where all the operating rooms were in the hospital. And then there was the, God, what was the building where the first ether demonstration took place, and that was for charity patients, okay? And so they had the strata of patients, and they decided to work on something called bleeding esophageal varices, which is a, when people drink too much, they begin to get liver problems, they begin to bleed, and you can go in and operate on them. And so my job was to go around, take blood samples before the operation, during the operation, after the operation, then do the clinical chemistries and so forth, and very primitive things in those days. We didn't have the machines that do everything like they do now. And then they could compare, see whether there were socioeconomic differences between the results of this stuff. And so we collected hundreds of patients, thousands of samples, and they never showed anything. Because there was no hypothesis. You didn't, you know, you could have stopped after 20 patients if you made a hypothesis that this was going to have an effect, and then you stop. They didn't. That's not the way things were done. But this was a, and they always, you know, it was always on call, and always these things came. Well, always emergency room things. Somebody came in the middle of the night with this thing, and I had to rush into the...
So was that your last clinical study?
Yeah, I stopped this because they began doing things with kids, and I couldn't take that.
Ah, really?
Yeah, I just couldn't take that. That's when I decided physicians... clinical medicine was not my dish of tea.
Interesting.
Okay, right, well, I'm sorry.
No, that's okay.
We're rambling all over the place.
What we're going to do is we're going to try... Yeah. You try to do your part of editing your transcript. We'll get this transcribed. We'll figure out where to put it.
Yeah.
Insert.
I got very... my memory is... as I'm thinking about this, you sent me a transcript, and I started going over it, and got through about 5 pages, and I had covered it with so much red ink that I said, this is not worth going on any further. So let me, we were starting on this other one at the same
yes.
time, and that was going much smoother.
Yes.
He was not just taking down conversations and then typing them up. He was beginning to provide things that I could then very carefully edit before it got along too far, so it began to be...
Yeah. So is there something, I mean, could we do some of that? I mean, would that be better to try to do some more?
Well, let me have a crack at a new document, okay?
Yes, that's
an
fine.
An amended document, and then I'll try and spend more time with it.
Okay.
It takes time to do this. That thing in addiction didn't come out easy. And then it got to the editor, and he took liberties, too. By the way, changed a lot of the language.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
See, what we want to do is we want to try to preserve.
Yeah, I know what you want to do, but he
aspect.
Had a different view.
Yes. So
and it was a British editor, and they
yes.
They have different ways of looking at.
Yes.
Things.
So would it make maybe it makes more sense for us to get this transcribed? I mean, my transcriber is not lightning fast, but she's not that slow. and drop these in and then send you the document.
That would
just
be
a single
with this
document.
Stuff
single
dro-
document.
Dropped
yeah,
in.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. And did it work okay to use to send the attachment via email and then you print it out?
Yeah, yeah, that's
okay.
Fine. Yeah,
and then you want to edit on it or do you want to edit electronically?
Well, if you send it as an attachment, we can always put the attachment into a PDF file, I suppose. I'd rather do it on the paper. I'm not
on the paper. Okay.
On the paper.
And,
I'm
you
sorry.
Want to send
no,
it
no,
back?
No,
old-fashioned.
You
want
to send it back annotated?
What we can do is either that or, it, depending on you know how much it looks like, what we can do is we still have it in electronically in our hands. We can then make the changes and send it back to you with the changes.
Sure.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
Sure.
So I will try to do that within the next
secretary is pretty good at that
month
stuff.
Or so.
She's a little too fast. She makes tends to work so fast she leaves out lines.
Oh,
sorry.
<yikes. laughs>
but I catch
happen.
Those.
Okay, so we'll do it that way. And see if that works better, mm-hmm. because we would like to get this up. It would be really ideal. I also think, we'll need to sort of make a case when we go to the National Library of Medicine, sort of about you and your sort of prominence and stature, et cetera. So, are there any pieces other than the addiction interview, which I've seen, that would be helpful to us in that regard? Have you done any memoir like?
Well, I've done a number of review articles years ago. I've stopped doing that stuff, too, because it's just too much work for anymore. And, I don't know. Most of the stuff recently that's been prominent about me has to do with my philanthropic efforts, which have nothing to do with this sort
yeah.
of thing.
All right, so at minimum, your CV
The CV is
be
huge.
Helpful
yeah.
And,
I don't know that you need all those publications and stuff. Does that maybe that impresses people? I'm not impressed
couldn't hurt.
By publications anymore. I mean, we tend in academia to publish too much these days, and instead of waiting and doing a much larger paper, but journals don't. Go for the big papers anymore. They mm-hmm. want to. You send a big paper in, and they send it back saying it's too long. Cut this out. Cut that out, and so on. And mm-hmm. It's difficult to do it.
Yeah. Well, let's.
Yeah.
See.
Okay. Yeah. Let me give you.